ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. This is Henrik. Good to have you all with us here on Red Ice. Today, so many developments in Europe right now. We have barely time to talk about the attacks in London before the attacks in St. Petersburg, followed closely by the attacks in Stockholm. Things are really heating up. So we have with us today Anne-Marie Waters. She is an English political activist and director of Sharia Watch UK. This is an organization launched by UK lawyers, actually, and they are coming up on their three-year anniversary here later in April. It's good to have you with us, Anne-Marie. Thank you for coming on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Excellent. So tell us a bit about first here, why you started, you know, before we get to the current news, as it were, but why you started Sharia Watch UK and what some of the background to this were.
I guess I just wanted to look a little bit deeper into things. The media would show little bits of things here and there about Sharia and how it was operating in this country and what it meant in this country. And I just wanted to look into a few different issues, shine a light on them. So I set up Sharia Watch UK, which is basically just reports on, writes about issues related to Sharia in the UK.
Now, tell us more then what this is and what some of the things that you found. When you started looking into this, how much did you know at the time? What did you think at the time before you kind of started to?
I'd been campaigning against Sharia for a long time. So I knew it. I just wanted to gather all the information together, put it in a place where people can easily read it. I started out with what were mainstream Muslim organizations deemed moderate, the kind of people who show up on news programs and current affairs programs. And when you look a little bit deeper, they believe in an ideology which wants to execute gays and where women are chattel. And, you know, I just wanted people to know that we're not the extremists here. I think a lot of these so-called moderate Muslims, when you scratch a bit deeper, their views are quite extreme and need to be brought out into public view.
Yeah, definitely, because we hear time and time again from the media, from the pundits and the talking heads that we have nothing to worry about. But it seems to me that many of these people have actually not read the religious scriptures and they're not really tapped into what many of these, as you say, moderate Muslim organizations really are advocating, right?
Yeah, and you know, they never want to get into what the scriptures say either. You know, all the debate on TV and again the news shows, and they never get into it. They never get into theology, and journalists and reporters openly admit they don't know anything about Islamic scripture. Yet they feel fully qualified and fully entitled to make these assertions about it, how it's peaceful. And I mean, even the Prime Minister stood up in the House of Commons after the London attack and said quite matter-of-factly that it was a perversion of a great faith. How does she know? I very much doubt she knows a great deal about Islamic scripture other than what she's advised by the very Islamic groups we're talking about. You know, Islamist ideological groups are, I've no doubt, who advises senior politicians because they're treated as moderates, but scratch a bit, just a little bit below the surface, and these are very extreme religious, extreme Islamists in many cases.
Yeah, exactly. So if you can then prove this to us, let's assume someone's listening who just doesn't know what you're talking about. Everything that they've heard is, well, this, there's nothing to worry about. This is a religion of peace, etc. Let's just outline some of the main big points that you know, that you're aware of, which contradicts that claim.
That Islam is a religion of peace?
Yeah.
Well, the first thing is to look at the world. Look at the world and use your common sense. There are a few really brutal theocracies in this world that stone and behead and live by medieval punishments and medieval ideals, and they're Islamic. There are countries in the world that execute gays, they're Islamic. There are countries in the world where women are absolutely property, have to live under guardianship, they're Islamic. Use your head. You know, how can you? Of course, there's not a coincidence that the most brutal theocracies in the world happen to be Islamic. You know, it's absurd. So that's the first thing you do, is look at the world around you and use your eyes, use your common sense. And then you just read the scriptures. The scriptures are objective. And you read and believe your own eyes. This is what I wish people would do, is simply open their eyes to the reality around them. And then they'll know that Islam is not a religion of peace. And in fact, most do know it. They're just afraid to admit it, often even to admit it to themselves. But I do believe there are millions of people out there who feel as I do.
So what do you think that is? Why do people shy away from this reality? Because I think I've been trying to read the mechanism, the psychological, how, you know, how people deal with this psychologically, basically. And it seems that sticking your head in the sand is actually creating a much more, for now, comfortable situation for them than actually facing the reality that we've opened our borders and opened the doors to a culture and a religion which is simply incompatible with the West. How do you view this?
Oh, I think that there are many reasons that people go into this state of denial. One of them is fear. People are actually afraid of violence, of you know, I've got their names getting out. I've people write to me and say, I'd love to help you, but if my name got out, I'd lose my job. Or they're afraid of violence. Other people, there's comfort in the lie. You know, it's much easier if I'm talking nonsense. You know, it's much easier to believe the BBC who say there's no problem than it is to face up to, this is a harsh reality to face. Of course it's easier. People want to go on in life as normal. They don't want to believe that this massive threat is hanging over them, but it is. And I think it's a huge problem because they're not bad people. They're not, you know, they just don't want to face these things. It's much nicer to live with the official story the government is telling them. It's understandable.
Yeah, definitely. Now, if we just focus on groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and everything else, we hear, of course, that these are extremist organizations, and obviously in their actions there are, but I've heard some people argue that they are, at the same time, a kind of a natural outcrop from what Islam preaches. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, they've all got their variations, insignificant variations. The core things are all the same across the board. But yeah, of course, you know, that regardless of what they call a certain sector, what group they divide themselves into, the core is, you know, death of the Jews is ordered. They all agree on this. Stoning comes from the scriptures. They all agree on this. You know, there are things that are there common across them all. And of course, they come from the scriptures. Anyone can see that. We can pick them up and read them. And that's the significant part. It doesn't matter how many different groups emerge. They're all after the same thing, which is Sharia law. And it's Sharia law that's the problem and not the group that's going for it. And Sharia law, when they activate, you know, activism for it politically as well, we treat that as if that's just another political opinion. No, it's not. They're advocating barbarism, and it shouldn't be respected on the public stage in the way that it is. So it's Sharia law that's the problem, and that's what they're all aiming for. So I don't really, what sex or different terror groups or how much dispute there may be among them is insignificant, because Sharia is the problem.
Right. So describe the situation in England and larger UK for us a little bit, because, you know, there's a couple of examples that we've seen now. Also, again, in the last few days, we had the bombing of the Coptic churches in Egypt. And I always felt this, you know, if this is how they treat a minority, if we look at the trajectory of the developments in the West, we are slated, as things are, you know, this is the reality of the trajectory we're on right now, to become at some point a minority in our own countries. Maybe two, maybe three, maybe four generations from now. Could even be sooner, depending on how many, you know, how much open borders we have in Europe. But how do you think that we would be treated as a minority in an Islamic society?
Ooh, not very well. Not very well at all. I don't think we'd be treated by overall very well if we were a minority. There's a lot of anti-Western propaganda everywhere, schools, universities, the media, everywhere. I don't think it would be very pleasant at all if we were a minority, no.
I've seen certain things in England, you know, there's been ISIS flags waved, there are certain areas, same in Sweden really, no-go zones, and supposedly there are people there that are trying to impose, you know, Sharia law. They apparently are setting up some of their own courts. What's the legal situation right now in England. Have they allowed this, or are these Sharia courts still operating under the radar at this point?
They are operating. Let me explain it. They are legally operating, but unlawfully. And I'll explain that. We have an Arbitration Act, for example, where people are free to set up arbitration tribunals and appoint their own judge and let that judge decide on their issue. And that can be legally binding. The Sharia councils have set up underneath those laws as arbitration. But the rules that govern that arbitration are that it should be fair, impartial, and in the public interest. Now, I would, as Sharia law openly gives a woman's testimony worth half of a man's, for example, that's unlawful under the Arbitration Act itself. So while they're using the Arbitration Act to legitimise their existence as arbitration tribunals, I would certainly argue they're acting unlawfully while they're doing it. But most of them, we have around 85. That's the figure that's generally accepted. I'd say informally, it's a lot higher than that. And they have, you know, they have their signposts outside the Islamic Sharia Council, and they operate as a charity. And the problem is that charities, if they are deemed to be promoting religion, regardless of the religion, then they can get charity status. So they use that to have Sharia, what are pseudo Sharia courts. So that's how they operate. But again, I would argue that they're probably not operating to the letter of the law, or at least they shouldn't be, of the Charities Act that governs charities. So it's a legal mess, to be honest. It needs a lot of clarification. I would like to put some of it before a judge and get it clarified.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that situation will change? I mean, if there is, as I said before, an increasing population that are Muslim, wouldn't the British Crown, I guess, at some point say, okay, well, you can do whatever you want. You can have your own court system because you're in this area, in this region, you're in the majority. And if this is what you want, you should be able to go ahead with that, right?
Yes, absolutely. And this is one of my worries, because I do think that unless there's drastic change among the political establishment in Britain, that's precisely what will happen. They will hand over control. It's much easier. You know, they do nothing about the crimes that are committed by widespread in Muslim communities, like FGM, for example, or child marriage. They do nothing about these things because it's too difficult. It brings them into confrontation with the imams, with the powerful imams organizations and the Muslim Council of this and the Muslim Association of that. It will bring them into conflict with all these people. And then, of course, they'll have the left shouting Islamophobia at them. It's a lot easier. And I think, actually, yes, in many ways they have already relinquished jurisdiction to them. I've known of, anecdotally, police to send women to Sharia councils.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, you know, some of the most radical preachers I hear come out of, you know, the UK. We, of course, in Sweden, we've had a lot of returning ISIS fighters, and they go to fight for ISIS as well. It seems that for some reason, many are more prone to become radicalized in the West, even in a way that some aren't in some other, you know, that are already a majority Muslim country, which is quite interesting. How is the situation with that in the UK? And are the, I don't know, is the authorities doing anything about this? Or what I've heard is that they're much allowed to operate in maybe not in the open, but they're not going after these people, right?
With the Sharia councils?
Yeah, and also just these radical preachers, right, that are actually very radical.
Oh, no, not at all. Nothing at all is done. Again, we've had a few over the years. Journalists go into mosques undercover. Record what's being said in them. Terrible, terrible things, often amounting to incitement to violence, which is a criminal offence and has been for a long time. And nothing at all is done about it. We also do nothing when we find them agreeing to marry underage girls on video, caught on undercover cameras. Nothing done about that either.
Yeah.
Again, you know, the thing is, there's so much of this. I say it as well with FGM. We've got so much FGM in this country, and despite it being a criminal offence, if we try to investigate and bring to trial every case of FGM, we'd basically do nothing else. You know, our court system would be clogged up with this. So it's just too widespread. So the option now, is simply to let it happen. They just don't have, the political will is not there for a start. But it, the resources, the pressure on resources it would take to prosecute all these crimes would be extraordinary. So they take the easy way out and just let it happen and effectively break away a separate jurisdiction under some of the worst people you could possibly have, some of the cruelest imams in the country.
It's remarkable. Obviously, FGM, female genital mutilation, you have other things going on, such as child marriage. They, as you say, throw gays off buildings, they stone people and all these kinds of things. Why is it, do you think, that then the lefties and the liberals and everything else are looking the other way when it comes to this issue? You see, to me, it seems to be a hierarchy of victim classes and agendas, if you will, that one trumps the other. And it seems that the left is willing to look the other way if it entails us housing, you know, or having a multicultural society, if that implies that our own law and order kind of goes out the window. It seems that they're willing to take that as a side effect of the greater benefit, in their view, which is multiculturalism and a so-called diverse society. But what do you think?
I think many of them actually want the law to go out the window. You know, the really hard Antifa, you know, the street and so-called anti-fascists mm-hmm. who turn up with masked faces everywhere, somebody is speaking that they don't like. This is a really hateful people. I've seen a lot of these up close, particularly when I was marching in Copenhagen. We had a lot of these Antifa lining the streets. And these are really hateful people. And they're driven by a hatred of the West in many, everyone is obviously individual and has their own driver. But collectively, there's a huge hatred of the West. And they like the chaos that all this immigration is bringing. And see Islamic immigration as a way of destabilizing us. They want the West to come crashing down, and that they, one of the many things they have in common with Islam is hatred of the West. These Black Lives Matter people as well, they want this violence in the street, it seems to me. They want the chaos, because it's all about smashing authority, isn't it? It's all about rebelling against authority. It's callous and childish.
Yeah, and dangerous, and I mean, it has great repercussions, of course, and maybe even for all future generations to come. We just have to see how this plays out. But it looks to me, you know, Anne-Marie, that this is not something that's going to go away. This is something which is just ramping up, you know?
This is permanent. I don't know why they align with these people. I just know that they're willing to overlook. I don't know. Is it a utopian dream? We'll crush it and build utopia on the ashes, not realizing that Islam is going to kill them before they get to build anything on the ashes. I mean, you saw it in Iran as well before the Islamic Revolution. The left helped the mullahs into power because it was going to overthrow the established order. And of course, the mullahs turned on the communists and jailed and killed them all. Mm. It's a pattern repeating. The left seems to ally. I think it was Pamela Geller said the left will ally itself with whatever the totalitarianism of the day is.
Yeah, they think they're going to end up on top or something or benefit in that situation. But yeah, it's going to be a pretty brutal and bloody conflict, I think, unfortunately, that we're looking at here at the end of the road if all this continues. So tell us a bit of who you think is responsible for this. I mean, I remember a couple of articles now coming out, I think about a year or 2 years ago. There was a book coming out about Tony Blair. It was talking about this issue of mass immigration, almost in the sense that he wanted to ensure Labour's future rule. And one of the ideas, the political ideas they had, is that if they could flood the UK with millions of migrants, this would ensure the position of the left. But so I think one of the lines that we used was that they wanted to rub it in Tories' faces, right? Of permanently changing the demographics of the UK. Is it the Blairs of the world that's responsible for this kind of stuff?
They're in they're high on the list, yeah, of people who are responsible for this. The Labour Party deliberately wanted to change the face of Britain for good, just as Merkel deliberately wanted to change the face of Germany for good, and they don't even hide it. You know, that Merkel knows perfectly well that she's that Germany won't be the same country again, and it won't be for the better. And for to make that decision in that knowledge, I think shows you the danger we're in when we have leaders like that in such positions of power. They want to change us. It's about as big an insult as a government can make towards its people.
Isn't it a crime, really? I mean, think about it. I think there was one politician in Germany there from the Die Linke, the left party, that actively were talking about how the fact that this was a good thing demographically because he had the audacity to call all Germans Nazis, right, by default. And he said that it's good that they're not reproducing as much and that we can bring in immigrants. I mean, isn't that a crime in a way? By law, it's like actively working against the interest of the majority group that's in that country, you know?
Well, if it isn't, it should be.
Yeah,
But
exactly.
how hateful is that? You know, these are the people who will shout hate at everybody else, hate at someone who objects to mass unvetted immigration. But how hateful is that to call the entire population of Germany Nazis and they know where to hit them?
Yeah.
And that they are glad they're dying out as a race and they deserve to die out as a race. I mean, what a hateful thing to say to people. And these very same people will shout hate to silence their opponents. It's an extraordinary thing. Everything is upside down. The real haters are people who say things like that, and then they project onto everyone else. Everyone else is a racist. It's actually they who are the racists. And to say that you're happy the German people are dying out is a terrible thing to say and a very hateful one.
Yeah, indeed, it's a crime. Now, tell us a bit about the London attacker here. And what's interesting about this situation to me is that we usually hear that, okay, it might be understandable if you have people that just arrived in the country, they are somehow violent. I mean, the left makes excuses all the time. One thing they do is that, well, these people are traumatized, they have, post-traumatic stress, and they're suffering from different things. If they act out or, accidentally gang rape a girl or something, we can look the other way because it's not their fault. They are the real
They're
victims,
victims
right?
too.
Yeah, they're the victims.
Too.
But when it comes to the situation in England here with the gentleman who did the killing with the car and jumping over the fence and killing one of the cops as well. He was a supposedly for many, many years, a well-adjusted individual. He was there. I don't know when his parents arrived to England. Maybe there was two, even three generations ago. I really don't know. But it seems that he was supposedly then on a path to he was well-adjusted to British society, right? But something happened and he was transformed along the way and he became radical. I think some of the studies that come out have shown that it's second or third generation that has the most propensity to become radicalized. What do you think that's about?
Well, he most of the 7/7 bombers were also adjusted, British and adjusted to British society, living in British society. The answer is the religion. They've essentially become devout. This is the one thing they all have in common, is that they become devout. I mean, this guy wasn't from a Muslim background. He was a convert. There are other converts, of course, involved in terrorism. But the obvious connection is the religion. And it's just a fact of life. So I think when people are converts, they can have a lot more fervor and be a lot more committed because they came to it for a reason, and whatever reason attracted them, they become really committed about. But people come from all different backgrounds to this. People have been refugees, people have been from wealthy families, people have been doctors, people have, they come from all backgrounds. And the one thing, of course, that they share is the religion and fervor to that religion. Pretty obvious what it is.
Yeah, it seems his name was Khalid Masood, but he was prior to that, before he changes his name, it was Adrian Russell, and he was married to a white woman who's living in a fairly affluent area, I believe. He was nothing makes sense until you start realizing that he was at one period he had actually gone to prison, and he seems to have been radicalized in prison. I mean, in America, they have this thing called Prizlom, right? Because it's such a problem that most of the people in prison they're have turned to Islam. And I guess it must be some kind of conversion environment within there too, that they they turn to that and they see that this is the only way out, or they feel, you know, better about themselves, they can start building themselves up. Is that what you think happened with Khalid or Adrian, as it's called?
Yeah, quite probably. I mean, it's, Tommy Robinson has talked about a lot. The prisons are dominated by Muslim gangs. There'll probably be a lot of forced conversions, but also a lot of, you know, these are guys who are suddenly told that they are the most powerful of men and given all this cause to fight for, and it's a breeding ground, and they've got nowhere else to go as well. Remember, they're in prison, they'll become completely immersed in it, and they have a lot of power when it comes, you know. It's when they, if they join up, they'll get a lot of it, a lot more power. And this is a culture in British prisons, as it probably is in some American prisons, and that's it. He's not the only one to go into prison and to come out a lot more radical than they went in. And as I said, like Tommy Robinson has said, these are breeding grounds. And, you know, the media has covered it. It's quite widely acknowledged. So it's a problem. What do you do then? What do you do with the jihadis? You put them in jail.
It gets worse, right?
Yeah. And they become even more committed.
Is this a dialogue in the UK? Is there anyone talking about this?
About prisons, yeah. It has been talked about. Some quite widely acknowledged, in fact. But as usual, nothing happens. We're very good at exposing problems, having a formal inquiry into those problems, and all the while the problem continues and gets worse.
But, yeah, we're looking into that. nothing happens. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Well, a formal inquiry happens. That's about it.
Right.
Say how things are, and then
let's raise the concern. It looks like we know what we're doing and that we're addressing it, but and meanwhile, of course, as I said, the borders are wide open. They're coming, people are flooding into Europe right now, which we have no idea who they are or where they come from or what their allegiances are, and obviously there needs to be some kind of sanity put into the picture. Let's compare two situations for a moment, shall we? We saw these images of Syrian kids plastered throughout the entire media in just here in the last few days. They showed little children suffocating. They showed all these horrible images of kids primarily that suffered from this, you know, chemical attack or accident or whatever it actually was. But we've not seen are these, and by the way, another example, we saw, of course, the child on the beach, Alan Kurdi, right? We saw him over and over. I mean, this child became a meme for us to open our borders and open our hearts, right? To let everyone in, basically. But what we've not have seen are the children that are now a consequence of mass immigration. We've not seen that Swedish little girl, Ebba, who was completely maimed by the truck in Stockholm. We have not seen the little child in Nice, who was lying under that blanket with a doll next to her. There was strollers standing on the side of the streets where kids had been knocked out of them. We are not seeing any of those pictures, are we now?
Isn't it just despicable? I mean, we are dealing with a media culture which is so determined not to shine a bad light on its open border utopia that they will do such an obvious thing. Because everyone can see that they are shoving down our throats anything that will make us keep our borders open. But anything at all that shines a bad light, they try and reframe it or try and cover it up altogether. It happens all the time. You see, in Sweden, it's particularly disgusting, where they blur the faces of rape suspects.
Yeah.
I mean, how are you? This is disgusting. Recently, I read of a Swedish newspaper which wouldn't give the ID of a serial sex offender, and the editor said it wasn't her job to help the police. They will do anything to keep their. I don't know why. It's completely irrational, but to keep their borders open. And anything that paints this in a bad light is out, and anything that they can ram down the West's throat to show us how awful we are and how irresponsible for the deaths of small children we are. It's so obvious, and it's absolutely despicable. Our mainstream media is despicable, and I'm glad it's losing its credibility in the way that it is.
I agree. You know, in Assad's case, it justified regime change. It justified the invasion. It justified firing Tomahawk missiles at the country, right? But in the West case, you don't have there's no Security Council that's meeting at the UN saying, you know what, these governments in Sweden and the UK and Germany and France, they have abdicated on the responsibility to protect their citizens. I mean, a country like Sweden is literally housing ISIS terrorists. It's giving them resources. It's supplying them with apartments and jobs, I guess in the hope that they think they're going to convert these people back to liberalism or something. But that's just not going to happen, right? But my point is you don't see that engagement on the international stage where they say, we have to protect the lives of these innocent children that have been murdered in the West. Right.
Oh, I mean, there should have been a long time ago international condemnation of the crimes committed against Germans and against Swedes since this massive flood through the open borders of Europe. There should have long ago been recognition of the abdication of responsibility of European governments to their people, and acknowledgement of racial crimes that are happening against ethnic Germans and ethnic Swedes. If this were happening, it's extraordinary that the UN never condemns these things. It's extraordinary that the UN never condemns other non-Western countries who don't want to take masses of so-called refugees.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary as well that in this migrant crisis, all the migration is going in one direction, which just happens to be Europe. No concern for this whatsoever. In fact, encouraged by the UN. There's something not right there. There's something not right there. There's deliberate anti-Western, deliberate anti-white international culture.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even hide itself. There's a lot of people would like to see the end of Europe, and a lot of those people have power.
Yep, that's absolutely right. You know, and you're right when you say that there should be condemnation, because ultimately, let's think of the situation too, even from the perspective of the left, that they should recognize that, you know, they are actually the ones who are putting a lot of these kids that are crossing the Mediterranean in danger. I mean, in the case of Alan Kurdi, it was actually his father that wanted to go for a dental fix-up in Germany, I think. And it was his irresponsibility that led to the death of this child, and coupled, of course, with this refugees' welcome attitude in the West, where they say, come here, you can get everything for free, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the governments are complicit in it, obviously. The irresponsibility of accepting everybody, with the left promising the world to everybody, of course, as night follows day, of course, crowds are going to follow more crowds when you take them all in and promise them the promised land. This is deeply irresponsible, and it is killing people. It's killing people who are making their way over, and it's killing people when they get here, who are, you know, it's killing Europeans as well.
Of course.
Absolutely extraordinary that it happens, and that it's still happening. I'm happy to say Britain has largely escaped that big influx. But obviously we have our own separate problems, but we haven't had this massive influx and these cologne type incidents. Quite shocking what's happening in Europe now.
I know it truly is. I mean, how do you think this is going to develop? I mean, let's talk about that for a moment then, in terms of Brexit and in terms of some potentially, I don't know, maybe a change in the direction of the UK compared to Europe. I mean, Europe has now forced the EU, I mean, not Europe, but EU has forced, or is trying to force, Bulgaria, Hungary, and all these other countries that want to remain remotely nationalistic to force them to take immigrants, force them to take refugees, et cetera, et cetera. And it looks like the EU might have been pushing it too hard. And if we can get a, let's say, Le Pen win in France, maybe something in Germany. I doubt the AFP will get in there, but, you know, we can hope. But if Le Pen gets in, you might have a Frexit coming up next. And I'm wondering if that's it for the EU, if that's the case, you know? What do you think?
You know, a significant amount of the future of Europe and in the future of Europe depends on whether or not Marine Le Pen wins that election. Generations of the direction for generations will depend on whether or not she wins that election. If she wins it, that will be the end of the EU. She will take it out of the EU, and it can't survive without both the UK and France. It would simply be Germany and a few far less wealthy countries. If she doesn't win, I think Brexit will happen. I think it will be a success. I think we'll break away and get pretty much what we want, because Theresa May is not going to risk the landslide she's got at the moment at the next general election. So I think Britain will break away. But if Le Pen doesn't win, and I think Merkel will win in Germany, to be honest, I think they are that suicidal in Germany. I think she'll win another term. And that will be continental Europe in tit-for-tat violence, chaos. We'll have our own in Britain, but not to the extent that they'll have on the continent. And it will only get worse. And eventually the EU will break down. But who knows how, whether it be, whether it's silently collapse or whether we have war on the streets, we'll see. But the European continent is in trouble, and the Le Pen win will decide which direction it goes in, and it'll be two very different directions. And I sincerely hope she wins.
Yeah, me too. I think regardless, though, I think that there's enough of population numbers right now in Europe that makes this a very difficult period ahead in the next 20, 30, 40 years, to be honest. And I just don't know. It depends on if we see a polarization and a radicalization and kind of a what seems to be happening is that you have micro societies inside of our own nations right now, kind of rising up. And in Sweden, of course, we do have these no go zones. No matter what people say or what the media is trying to say, that these doesn't exist and whatever. It's like we've seen now time and time again what happens. I mean, even actually after the terror investigation that was done by the Uzbekistani Muslim that did this attack in Stockholm. The police tried to go in a certain area. I think it was Rinkeby, a suburb of Stockholm, to make further arrests, I think, or inquiries or something like that. The cops had, you know, there were stones thrown at the cops and the cars, and they basically can't do their job. That implies that it's a no-go zone, right? When the law of the country itself, the host country, can't even go into its own region, right, that it controls.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the definition of a no-go zone. And I did read that the police had stones thrown at them. But this is a regular occurrence in Sweden these days, as is hand grenades. As are hand grenade attacks are now a fairly regular occurrence in Sweden as well. It's Sweden, poor old Sweden. I don't actually agree that it's too late for Europe. I think we have to realize that we're still the vast majority.
Yeah, it's never too late.
He's right. And Sweden is in maybe in a terrible position, but I still think it's so difficult. They need to stop the immigration first and then start deportation. This in itself will cause a lot of trouble. It's a difficult way back, but it has to be. They have to start turning it back. We all have to start turning it back.
Yeah. I mean, what's the other scenario? I mean, it's what we've seen now, the consequence of the experiment that is multiculturalism. And I've said for years that, you know, Sweden, my country, it's like that's been a social experiment. It's been a petri dish of how to turn a homogenous, functioning, very well-off society into a complete just train wreck in literally just a couple of decades by importing massive amounts of people into it that just are incompatible and doesn't want to integrate into society, many of them at this point. Just doesn't work. But I think nonetheless that, you know, there's going to be trouble down the road. I mean, I don't see anything else out of the situation. I think that if it continues as it does now, Anne-Marie, I think that it is going to lead to conflict, and that seems to be kind of what multiculturalism gives us at the end, right? I mean, what other awesome benefits is there to multiculturalism, really? What is it?
Well, we have good takeaways. Apparently, that's a good enough reason.
Oh, you mean like takeout food or something?
Yeah,
Exactly.
You'll actually hear that from leftists over here.
I know. What would you do? You couldn't go to the corner shop at 2 a.m. after you've been drunk on a Saturday and get a kebab, right? Oh, disaster.
Syria is worth it. Now, multiculturalism is essentially, to me, a way of allowing certain groups to live outside the law of the land. It's a way of allowing, and again, with Islam in mind and some of the practices that come with it, like FGM and like child marriage, it's a way of legitimizing the fact that you have to let those people live outside the law because they are refusing to live in accordance with our law. So to dress that rather alarming fact up in virtuous diversity clothes and call it multiculturalism and then celebrate it. But I love it. It's devious.
Amazing. So you mentioned, deportation, and I agree with this. I think for people to live amicably and peacefully, you can't have forced assimilation. You can't have forced, or rather the removal of freedom of association like we have now where people are, placed into certain regions and areas which are deemed, well, in America's case, that some of them are deemed simply too white. That's an actual quote that the housing, the urban development used to find and pinpoint, locates zip codes that was, quote, racist just because they were too white. So they actively went in and tried to settle, refugees and immigrants in some of these areas to diversify them, right? And this has led to tremendous problems. So just look at, for example, a state like Minnesota, where you have a high Somali population that has arrived. I mean, it leads to chaos, right? It leads to conflict. So I think the freedom of association is one of the biggest, variables in this. That we that's something you must have. And I think by default, most people are happier in their own country with their own people. I know there's going to be some blend over. I know there's people traveling in these. There's a natural, way that this goes about when you have the kind of travel that you do. But everything that we've seen in the last decade or so now is completely artificial when it comes to population movements and advocacy of large movements of people from one culture and area into a completely foreign culture and area, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the idea is for a global, to blend the whole globe. I think that's the utopian idea. Some of us don't want to. I like the fact that there are Spaniards. I like the fact that Canada exists. I like a bit of variety and colour in the world. But of course, the extreme leftist utopia that drives a lot of their thinking is for a global blend where we're all going to go in together. And of course, the core big business benefits from this because labor markets shift and wages come down, especially in the West. And we've seen that a lot in the West. So the big businesses love the shift population. Power-hungry governments love it because it gives them excuses to bring in more and more restrictive laws. It's a globalist dream. It's globalism. They want to control. They want to bring down the nation state effectively and replace it with the corporation and a rich elite. And that's why it's so bizarre that the left is all over it. And,
I know.
Providing such assistance to these corporate giants who are moving people around for cheap labor, but you could explain it all day to them and they still won't get it.
No. And again, they don't care who they team up with because at the end of the day, they might have different ideas of how to reach that goal, but they all want the same at the end,
Yeah, they're ideologues, they don't do real world. It's always the utopia that they seek and they won't settle for anything less. That sort of attitude and temper tantrums they're living in an ideology. They don't applying it in real life never gets into their considerations. And that's of course where the hard stuff is. When you actually have to put ideologies into practice and put principles into practice, that's when the work starts and that's when it becomes difficult and you have to make choices. But no, they live in an ideology and they're very dangerous with it.
Yes, they are. Well, tell us a bit more about Sharia Watch UK, the organization. Tell us if there's a way that people can help the group. Tell us if there's something you guys have got going on that people should know about listening.
Please check out the website, shariawatch.org.uk. Always looking for contributions from people. If people have a story that they want to send in, something that's something they've. I mean, for example, we've had a lot of people contact us about what their children have been taught in school, and children having to visit mosques and this kind of thing. So we always look for people. We want to learn as much as we can about Sharia. So if anyone has any stories, to please get in touch. And we're always looking for help. So, and we're always looking for donations, obviously, as well. So yeah, check out the website, shariawatch.org. Okay, and read the reports that we've already done, because there's some good information in there that you won't be able to get together in any other place.
Excellent. Well, thank you for coming on, Anne-Marie. I really appreciate it. Keep up the good work, and I hope we can speak again in the future.
We will do. We'll organize it in the next. I can happily do one next week.
All right, there we go, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening today. Also, my thanks to Anne-Marie Waters for joining us. We'll try to get her back here soon for a second segment in hour two to hear more about the situation in the UK and about her organization as well. We'll be back with more in just a couple of days. Keep your eye peeled on the website. Much more coming. Also, of course, don't miss our live TV show upcoming this Saturday, April 15th. We are doing that live at Red Ice Members. .com, exclusive for members, in fact. So do get your hands on a membership. That's the best way to support us. This is also the best way to help us remain ad-free. And this way we can also bring on more reporters, correspondents, editors, and everything else to bring you more. We'll wrap up for now, but keep an eye on redice.tv and redicemembers.com for the latest. Until next time, have a great day wherever you are. We'll talk soon.